Hi, and welcome to The Art of Relating. I'm your host, Zach Schwartz, and I am a psychologist out there. Right now, I'm your radio host, and we're not doing therapy or counseling over the radio, but we are learning a set of skills together on effective humanistic interaction, and hopefully integrating those skills so that we can actually use them in our life at work and at home. Today and next week, I want to talk about addictions because they're so rampant in our culture, and how it relates to the art of relating is addictions are not free choice behaviors. When we act out of addiction, we're not controlling or making choices or being responsible about what we say or do. So a lot of relationships get damaged when a person who's addicted to something makes promises or offers the delusion of controlling their behavior with regard to that addiction. So, for example, if a person who's addicted to opiates but is threatened with divorce by their spouse, if they continue to use, may promise that they won't use anymore. But that promise is impossible to keep because they're not choosing or being responsible for their addictive behavior in the first place. But more on that later. Right now, what did I forget? We're supposed to ground first. So ground with me now. Find center. Get your feet on the ground. Relax. Remember, it's create a good base. Your bottom half is attached to the ground. Your top half is relaxed but holding a shape that is centered and that is confident and that is strong, not aggressive, not acquiescent. And then take a couple of deep breaths, filling both chambers as you do. Remember, relaxed muscles and joints let energy move, and remember that emotions are energy and you don't want to hold them. You want to let them go. You want to have energy to use when you need it, but otherwise try not to suppress or hold energy because it makes it harder to share affection or to have free will or to act responsibly. So shake out the kinks. Make sure your chronic places of tension, different for different people, are loose and open. And self-talk. Relax, affirm, and unhook. So chill out. Calm down. I'm a good person. I'm doing the best I can in this moment. It's all small. I'm just a speck living on a speck. Remember, unhook from your ego drama. If you remember the transpersonal sessions, this is a good time to turn on the awareness in you that is light. When I say turn on, I mean become aware of it. Be that one. I am 67, but I'm also 14 billion. And when I ground, I become the 14 billion year old light set that I am, so that I can relax and I can be in the moment and I can function at my best. Also, remember, you can write to me at Zach@KEPW. If you have a question or comment about the show, I'll be glad to answer it on our next go-round. And visit the website dyneskills.com, where you'll find books and podcasts of this radio show and trainings and workshops, because the art of relating is all about integrating the skills that you've learned, internalizing it, getting it so you're familiar with it, so you're in a habit of thinking that way, so you're in the habit of acting that way, and that takes work and practice. And now, back to our study of addiction, which is this week and probably next week at least. What does it mean to be addicted to something? If you take drugs as an example, but it's just an example, anything in your life that carries power or coping ability, has an addictive potential. Can be sex, it can be money, it can be a drug, it can be food, it can be anything that offers a reward has the potential to create a habit or an addiction, and even those are different. So take a drug, for example. I would contend that any drug can be used or abused, or you can be habituated to it, or you can be addicted to it, and all of those are different from each other. Use is no apparent damage, has positive coping value. I'm not habituated, I'm not addicted. If I, for example, enjoy a glass of wine as an aperitif for dinner, that may well be just a positive use of that wine. It doesn't carry the damage or the habit that has all the negative consequences associated with drinking too much. Abuse is a measure of whatever damage that substance or that activity might cause. So is it hurting my ability to do my job? Is it damaging my coping system in other ways? Is it having a negative effect on my parenting, responsibility, or sharing love, or my partnership with my spouse, etc., or my budget? Any damage that activity or substance is doing is a measure of abuse. I'm abusing it to that degree. That's something I may want to consider making a change about, because abuse is not a good thing. Then some people say using a substance over time get habituated. Well, what's that? Habituated is when I'm no longer making a choice in my behavior to use or not use that substance. So conditioning, and we've talked about that before, classical or operant, creates over time a habit. And a habit is no longer a choice. It's something I'm going to do whether I choose it or not. Habits are automatic behaviors. They involve being triggered and having an urge and then acting out. And I am not being responsible at that moment. Now, addiction is yet another thing and often goes with habituation. Most addicts are also habituated. But addiction specifically means that I can no longer experience myself as coping without that item in my life. I have to have it. We're all, in a sense, addicted to oxygen, have to have it to cope with my life. But there's a lot around still, and it's free, and no one's making a profit off it. And as long as that's true, that addiction doesn't present too much of a problem unless there's no oxygen available, and then I'd have to find some quick. But in the case of a substance, addictions are not free. There's always a cost, many costs, and I still feel like I have to have it to cope, which means if I have to defy my own ethics, for example, if I have to lie or steal or cheat to get that substance, then I would. If there was a limited amount of oxygen available or I had to buy it, then you would see people doing the same thing for oxygen that addicts do for, say, heroin, if they're addicted to that substance. It's not about choice. It's about have to have it. Now, every living creature has needs and desires. They tend to be motivated to move toward things that they think will make them happy or meet their needs. that's normal functioning. So we are pushing ourselves generally toward getting our desires or needs met. And each of us has stress, and stress is caused by the things that get in the way of that need fulfillment or getting our desires met, or the cost, nothing's free, in anything we partake in. Measured together, that cost and the things that block our need or desire fulfillment create a strain on our being, and that strain is a measure of our stress. So each of us develops a coping system, which is all the ways in your lifestyle that you try and keep yourself moving toward fulfillment of those needs and desires and dealing with the stress that the frustration of those or the use of those may produce. Now, each of you listening to this program, for example, have a coping system that works to some degree. That is to say, you made it this far, you've gotten some things that you need and some things that you want, and you deal with your stress at least enough to survive to this moment. You have a coping system which is made of coping elements. Some of those elements are external, like friends, or the money you have in the bank, or a job, or a church you belong to, or another organization that you're a member of, or the possessions that help you, like your car, or your furniture, or the dishes in your kitchen. Your external coping elements help you deal with stress and help you meet your needs. The good thing about external coping elements is that they can be strong when you are weak. They're available and they're countable. So you can tell me, if you wished, how much money you have, or what your house is like, or about people that may care for you or support you. Those are all external elements. So the good things about external coping elements is that they're concrete, they can be strong when you're not, they're countable, they're definable, they're easy sort of to measure and talk about. The hard thing about external coping elements is that they're temporal. Whatever starts, stops. Whatever you have, you lose. The manifestation of the physical is a temporary phenomenon, so we all have to deal with loss and grief, and those externals are not always available. And yet, we can get attached to them, and we can feel like we need them. And as Buddha pointed out, as I understand him, those attachments and those needs that happen with the external coping structures lead to a variety of problems, as most of you well know. Coping systems generally also include internal coping elements, like your sense of identity, your sense of purpose, your sense of humor, your sense of God or universe, your abilities, your self-talk. Now, all these internal coping elements are not temporal. That's the good news. You get to take them with you. They write up to death and maybe beyond. You get to keep them if you want to. They're just yours. The hard thing about internal coping elements is that they're hard to define, and they're hard to work on, and they're hard to generate, harder than the externals many times. So if I ask you, say, how much money you have in the bank, that's external, you could tell me. But if I ask you, what's your sense of identity, who are you really, you may answer with, well, I'm not sure what you mean by that, or it's not clear to me. They're harder, intangible, to get a hold of on many occasions. Many years ago, I wrote a dissertation, part of my graduate work, on addiction, and particularly opiate addiction, and coping system analysis or strength. And what we found, no surprise, was that the more broad and strong one's coping system, the less potential there was for them to develop an addiction. If you have an item in your coping system that you use to help you cope in a critical way, and that you have no alternative to that structure, you may find yourself attached to it. Like you can't, without that item, your whole coping system won't work. And that is one way to understand addiction. No matter what I have going for me, if I'm addicted to something, I have to have it. And remember, a lot of people use the words habit and addicted interchangeably, but they're not exactly the same. A habit is a repeated behavior that has enough reward that you can't any longer choose not to do it. It happens automatically. Addiction is about not being able to cope without that item. Without that item, my whole coping system will collapse. I don't feel like I can survive without it. There's a book written a long time ago called Love and Addiction, which makes this point very clearly. I recommend it as reading about distinguishing between those two very powerful forces. One way to think about independence is to think of it as the opposite of addiction. If I'm independent of some item in my coping system, then I have other ways to get my needs and desires met and to survive the day or my life without that item. That tends to define me as not addicted to that item. I can do without it. Independence is a very powerful concept to understand in a relationship with a person, with a drug, with a job. Remember, independence is critical in terms of having personal power, being able to negotiate, being able to set limits, being able to do without if I have to. I believe it's a reasonable goal to be addicted to as few things as possible. I can't help it with some things, like, for example, as I said, oxygen or potable water. Those are things I need to survive that can't be easily replaced. But everything else, I can find alternatives for in order to get my needs met and get my move toward meeting my desires without the problems that come from habituation or addiction. So how do I approach these things? How do I treat myself so to control habituation or addiction? Remember that anything that carries a reward, if I work with a person who does cocaine, for example, and when they do the cocaine, they have, you know, 10 or 20 minutes of a very positive feeling. They're at ease, they're happy, they're energetic. And then the rest, what some call the wire, the rest of the experience, the money, the drug, how I feel an hour later or 10 hours later or a day later, or the damage it does to my home, my family, can all be horrible. But that one 10-minute, what they call rush of euphoria, of focus, of energy, is enough to create the habit over time. And since the cycle with cocaine is very short, it's very habituating because it goes reward and then cost, reward and then cost, maybe even several times an hour. So very habituating. So what do I do about a habit? And my the same thing can happen. Remember, this is not just about drugs. The same thing can happen with a loving relationship, or with money, or with any activity or item that brings me any amount of pleasure or relief. It's often when the cost for a behavior that is that I've become habituated to or addicted to gets high enough, I may be open to getting help. I've done a lot of work in my life with people that were addicted or habituated and came in for help. And the trouble has gotten so bad, the cost of that coping element, that they are ready to do something about that. So they're very focused on the cost, they're very focused on the pain, they're very focused on their need to stop. And often when I work with groups, for example, I'll ask them, what is the coping value of that behavior? What was the reward for doing that drug or that sexual activity or whatever it was that they became habituated or addicted to? And they will tell me what's wrong with it, what the cost is, why they need to stop. And I'll say, wait, I'm asking you the opposite question. I'm asking you about the reward, because if you can define the coping value of whatever that behavior is, then you can start to build replacements in your coping system to acquire that. So often, for example, if you say to a group, why do you get high? Why do you do a drug? They'll say, for the rush. I'll say, oh, well, what exactly is a rush? And they will say commonly, danger or excitement. And I will say, no, I don't think so. I think danger or excitement can produce a rush, but a rush is a different thing. So I was working with a 20-year-old who is a professional snowboarder, and he had extreme anxiety. And I said, you know, when you get off a chairlift and you point your snowboard down the mountain and you take off at 80 miles an hour, what's the level of your anxiety? And he said, zero. And I said, well, how can that be? You're chronically anxious and you say you can't make it stop. And he said, well, when I'm skiing, my mind is on the snow and is one in the moment with what I'm doing, because if my concentration breaks, I could die. So it holds my attention. I said, ah, and when something holds your attention, you can't obsess about other thoughts, which is how you keep yourself in a high state of anxiety. So when you're having a rush, you're one with what you're sensing. You're not having obsessive thought patterns and therefore aren't anxious. And he said, yes. And I said, well, do you need to go 80 miles an hour down a mountain to make a rush happen? And the answer is no. You can rush on any moment of your day. It doesn't require danger or excitement. It's just that those things automatically do it. So you don't have to train yourself except in the activity that produces it. And that's enough to make it happen. But can you have the same rush eating a bowl of Cheerios or walking down the street or talking to a friend? And I would argue that yes, you can. But you need to bound your attention. You need to hold focus. That's what, incidentally, meditation is. It's the practice of holding focus. And if you can do that, you can direct your attention and therefore have a significant effect on your health and on your emotional state. So I think generally, great set of skills to learn. Everybody should have, I think, some meditative exercise in their regimen, because that's how you get that focus. So the rising cost of a habit or an addiction is what usually brings people to want to do something about it. And so most programs and most common sense approaches to habits or addictions involve a concentration on extinguishing the negative behavior, the behavior that's causing the problems. But that alone can leave you in a state of need or desire deprivation. So just cutting out the behavior that's costing you so much without recognizing the reward associated with that behavior, I think is treatment that's incomplete. A major part of the treatment has to do with developing coping alternatives, recognizing the rewards for those behaviors, and figuring out how you're going to get those needs or desires met in a healthier way. So remember, and we're going to talk about this more next week, that being habituated or addicted to as few things as possible is a reasonable life goal. When you're not addicted and you're not habituated, you have more access to your free will. You're more reliable. You're more trustworthy. You can act in a way that's consistent with your values and with your ideals and with your common sense. So all the things we learn about how to relate effectively are served by having a coping system that's independent enough and broad enough and strong enough that you're as habituated or addicted to as few things as possible. Remember, not all habits are bad. If the reward for a habit is substantial and the cost is low, you may want to keep that one. But for the sake of this training, be aware this week of, see if you can make a list of habits, things that are for you automatic behaviors that you're going to do whether you decide to do them or not. And especially if there's any things you would define yourself as addicted to, make a list. Like, awareness is one preliminary piece of changing habits, of gaining that personal power. So be aware of what those habits are and notice what triggers that kind of behavior, how you feel when that behavior starts to manifest itself. Start a little logbook, if you will, so you start to internalize, so you start to integrate some of this as it applies to you. And as you go through your day or your week, all of us have some of them. And you might even go as far as to measure the costs or rewards for each of those. So I have this habit. Here's how it rewards me. Here's how it costs me. And cost is not, of course, just money, but it could be stress or affecting my lifestyle in some negative way. And from there, I can just start to design a program that not only extinguishes that behavior, but also helps me develop coping replacement so that I can live in a healthier, freer way, which makes me more suitable to start trusting reliable relationships, healthy relationships. And remember, that's what the program's about. So write in with questions, comments. Return to the show next week, not out of habit, but because you choose to, if you think sharing these things is helpful or interesting and applies to the life you're living now. Have a great week, and relate well. See you Monday.